Hello, this is Leah Saudi here, and I am at the apartment of Frederick Strager. Did I get that right?
Oh, you sure did.
Okay, great. I got it out of the way early, you know what I mean? Because I didn't want to like meander on and then forget how to pronounce that. It would have colored the rest of the interview, right? The rest of the podcast.
People have pronounced it in many different ways over the years.
Strager.
You know, if I go to the States and I check into a hotel, they will always say, "So, Mr. Strange, how long will you be staying with us?"
Yeah. I've had the similar problems my whole life.
But it's Saudi, right?
It's Saudi, you know, just pronounced like the country. But the first name, I think, where I grew up in small towns in Northern Ireland and stuff, I was like the only foreigner, you know, the only one with a weird Muslim name or whatever. So people would just think it said Lisa, you know. So sometimes you'd be doing gym and it would be like, Lisa Saudi, you know. And that was the kind of thing when you were like, you know, 11
but it's Leas.
It's Leas.
So they misread it as Lisa.
I think if you look at it, it's exactly the same letters. So it just like looks like maybe it's a typo, you know. So I was singled out for that, you know, which was tough, but we've moved on.
Is Leas short for Elias? Is that kind of the same?
No. It's exactly the same, but without the E.
Yeah.
You know, it's a Berber name. It's from the North African Kabylie kind of region, you know. But yeah, I'm here today to talk about, I thought like fatality and aging and stuff like that. I read an article recently about the lifespan of musicians and about how your average musician has a lifespan around 20, 25 years below the average. I think this is a UK average I'm running off here. I don't know how long you Swedes live. Probably slightly longer, I'm guessing, all the pickled herring and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, so we're talking 50s, you know, and I've seen this reaffirmed many times, you know, like it's kind of like it makes sense. It adds up to me instinctively. I think we do live like less, you know, so I got this into my head recently and started considering, well, maybe I'm in my autumn years. These are my autumn years, you know.
But how old are you anyway?
I just turned 38.
Okay, so at least you didn't join the 27 club.
I didn't join the 27 club, you know. I mean, it was I don't think we made a good enough kind of... our first record didn't come out until I was 27, I don't think. So it would have been a real flash in the pan, you know, and it wasn't all that successful, so...
You just released Forgiveness Is Yours, the fourth album by Fat White Family, and you recently described the recording of the album as a fucking marathon of weirdness, dysfunction, and interpersonal mess.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I would change the word from mess to hell now. From when that press release was written, things got worse, you know? Things like you think you've reached the bottom, but then there's a bottom beneath the bottom, you know? And then you give up expecting to reach the bottom, you know? Where it's just like dysfunctionality squared, you know what I mean? Like self-multiplying, you know, interpersonal kind of failure, you know? I think the roots of it were in the pandemic. I think the pandemic were... I think that was a moment when everybody kind of changed tack, you know?
In what way? Did, like, isolation create tension within the band?
I think there was isolation and separation, but I think, personally, it revealed... you had no choice but to kind of tuck into your actual self in that period of isolation. You had no choice but to kind of accept yourself on some level, you know? And I think in that period, I realized that I was reverting back to who I'd been before I left Northern Ireland at age 18 to study art in London, you know, which was basically a nerd, you know? I think I moved to London, wanted to sleep with women. They didn't want to sleep with me. So I started like drinking religiously and taking like shitty drugs because I was afraid of people, you know. And that went on for about 16 years. And then the pandemic struck. And then I started reading and kind of like, I don't know, the solitude was kind of really good for me, you know. But for musicians, it's not such a great thing, you know. I think for the musical ilk, for the purely musical ilk, I think it was a real fucking disaster, you know, because that whole ecosystem was just disappeared overnight, you know. But I don't really consider myself a musician, I guess is what I'm saying.
Really?
No, not really. It's just one thing that I do, you know what I mean? I'm a bit of a jack of all trades, I think. You know, I'm as interested in writing and that side of things as I am in music, you know? Like, I'm more of a performance artist than a writer than I am a musician, per se, you know? I find musicians almost, I find them almost intolerable, you know?
3 years ago, during the pandemic, you put out the short film called Moonbathing in February, which is partly about you working on this record. And you're on the beach in Hastings in the winter, tripping on mushrooms and trying to jam with a guitar and a tiny synthesizer.
Yeah.
What was that like? And did a lot of that stuff end up on the record?
Some of it did end up on the record, I think, you know. There's the archivist, the opening spoken word thing when we're all laying on the beach in the middle of the in the middle of the night in February, you know, that wound up being the intro to the album.
Oh. It must have been awfully cold.
It was brutal. It was brutal, you know? But it was like, that was the last time I think I remember that particular kind of crew working together, and it not just being harmonious, but being like an absolute pleasure, you know? And I don't know how things went wrong between now and then, but at that point, we were so kind of in love with each other in that moment that kind of taking all of our clothes off on Hastings Beach in the middle of February, in the middle of the night, high on mushrooms, seemed like a pleasant kind of feat that we would achieve together, you know? And it was a real buzz, you know? It was a real kind of strange high, that whole thing.
Your guitar player, Saul Adamczewski, who was a founding member of the band, he left the group during this recording. And he, of course, has left the band before and returned. What made him leave this time?
I think he was kind of just not really interested in doing it anymore. I don't know. And every time I was trying to put like vocals down, he would just go into hiding in his room or whatever, you know. And you know, he wanted to make a kind of like ambient drone kind of album, or you know, like Metal Machine Music Part 2 or something like that, you know. And I had these songs, and Nathan, my brother, had these songs, and he didn't really want to record them, you know? And it just became this kind of, like, tiring kind of charade, you know? Where it was a bit like shit or get off the pot kind of thing, you know? I just think it had run its course for him. I mean, I'd never say never, but the animosity between us now is richer than it's ever been. I there's no love lost there anymore.
But he, of course, is not the first person to leave Fat White Family. I think that you've had 33 members. I'm not sure of that number, but
yeah, because something like that. It's not really a band. It's more of an idea, you know, like liberalism or tennis. You know? You know what I mean? Nobody is definitively in or out of tennis. You know what I mean? Like, some people are playing tennis and some people aren't, you know? And either side of that dichotomy, you know, it's interchangeable for innumerable reasons, you know? You can pick up your racket at any time.
So you couldn't really compare this to the 66 people that have played with The Fall over the years?
I never thought of myself as a kind of Marquis Smith character. I'm too much of a people pleaser, you know? That was really more Saul's kind of a vibe.
Like, well, you did write a song called I Am Marquis Smith.
Yeah, but that was while I was on ketamine and I actually believed it at the time, you know? I actually believed it. I was like, I am Marquis Smith, but I've just been denying that. But the nature of the beast is I've been kind of pushed into that kind of like inevitably kind of Marquis Smithian kind of position of just having to roll on with whoever's to hand. You know, I don't entirely mind that. And I don't think it's a terrible way to run a group. I think there's a lot of like, there's a completely different set of parameters like economically these days for being in a group, right? Every single person I know that's in a kind of Fat White Family level group, a kind of middling indie group, you know, every single one of them that's like making their bread and butter with music has to play in 2, 3, 4 different projects to get by, you know? So there's this kind of like rotating cast in the South London music scene where everybody's just playing in everybody else's groups. You know, one, because it's kind of creatively enriching or whatever, but two, because you just have no fucking choice, you know what I mean? It's like the minute like you get off of one tour, you jump onto another project and it just keeps rolling around, you know? I mean, it's a pain in the ass when you're booking things. You know, like I had my saxophonist on the phone yesterday. He was like, oh, I might need to miss the odd gig because I have to do gigs with the Primal Scream have come in. Bobby Gillespie's come in and poached. our saxophonist, you know what I mean? Like, he doesn't have enough blood on his hands already. You know? So, but, you know, that kind of thing. And I get all upset about it. I take it personally, you know what I mean? I'm like, well, you'd rather play out, you know, you'd rather go and play out with Bobby than with me, you know? I mean, it hurts, but at the same time, people have got to earn their bread, right?
So it's not like 30 years ago when, like, when an indie group signed with a major label, then they could go and buy apartments in London. You know, they could afford a flat.
This is the thing. It's a complete misnomer. Like, that's just, it's not even a fantasy.
I mean, Fat White Family is one of the most popular groups in England, or most written about, at least.
I think so, most written about. But if you're selling about 3,000 or 4,000 tickets in London on a tour or whatever, you know, and you're at about that level, I think back in the day, yeah, there'd probably have been enough money from record sales to entertain the notion of buying somewhere to live, you know, so you could go and deal with your drug problems and everything behind closed doors, you know. I mean, like, I was reading about, you know, Dave Berman, who's on some of the tracks, on one of the tracks that we're going to listen to today, you know, and I was reading about the Silver Jews and how he'd made enough money through record sales to buy a little house in Nashville in the 90s or whatever. And I was just like, wow, like, you know, the Silver, you know, through that output, he was able to buy somewhere to live.
Which track by David Berman did you want to play?
Well, it's the Purple Mountains. The Purple Mountains. That I think it's the second, maybe the second choice there. You know, from his last album, I guess. People call it a suicide note. I think that's an oversimplification, maybe. But yeah,
snow is falling in Manhattan.
Yeah,
snow is falling in Manhattan in a slow diagonal fashion. On the Sabbath, as it happens, snow is falling in Manhattan. If it looks like it might be a bad one, good caretakers.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
If you're taking care of a senior loved one, then you know it can be hard. Remember, it's okay to ask for help. There's a reason why 29 million families have turned to Care.com. Experienced senior caregivers can help with everything from meal prep to taking your loved one to doctor's appointments. And every caregiver you hire is background checked. So important for peace of mind. Find full-time, part-time, or even occasional help that fits your family's schedule and budget. Get the support you need with Care.com.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you if people send you the same generic conversation starters they message everyone else? Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Your younger brother Nathan Saudi plays keyboards in Fat White Family. Does having a brother in the band make it easier to collaborate because you're a family for real?
Well, it did until we fell out majorly during this album. I mean, we fell out during the last album, but we fell out so much worse on this one, you know. I think when Saul went, it was kind of like, you know, like when Saddam went in Iraq, you know. And for a minute, everybody thought, like,
he sounds charming.
No, I'm only joking. But you know what I mean. There's a moment where everybody thought, okay, we'll run this. Well, things are going to pan out, you know. And then it just descends into bloody factionalism, you know? And it's like somebody bombs a school, nobody fucking knows, you know what I mean? And things get so ugly, like you actually start pining for the days of Saddam, you know? That's how it was when me and Nathan were left in charge of the ship, you know? I mean, the thing is, like, when Saddam's around, you know, somebody disappears, it's like, well, you know, it's probably Saddam, right? But after Saddam, it's like, you know, who bombed the school? Like, I don't fucking know. No idea. It could be A, B, C, D, you know what I mean? You're in a realm of chaos, you know what I mean? I think it's like, I mean, I think Springsteen said, right, like, a band is not a democracy, it's a dictatorship. But then he would say that because he's the boss, right?
He sure is.
You know what I mean? It's predictable. But is it easier? It's been, I don't recommend it to anyone. I don't think it doesn't usually pan out well historically, right? I mean, there's that, why Sparks, they seem to get on okay. What other brothers are there in band? I mean, the Gallagher's famously awful. The Kinks, famously awful. It's usually fucking terrible, and it usually splits the family, you know what I mean? Like, me and my brother now are the kind of like, you know, like in The Godfather, you know, Godfather 2, when it's like, you know, when you go and see your mother, I want 2 weeks notice, you know, so I'm not there, you know? We're almost at that point now, you know, where we're kind of like space. We need space from each other.
And you have another brother, an older brother called Tamlan as well, whose circumcision inspired the song Today You Become a Man. On the new record, it sounds like a piece of spoken word poetry over an abstract jazz track almost.
Yeah.
How did you come up with the idea to write about your brother's circumcision?
If you're with my brother and you're getting kind of wrecked, you know, which is something you often wind up doing with my brother, you know, around 3, 4, 5 a.m., you know, when you're kind of, you know, a couple of bags deep and worse for wear, that's when the circumcision tale will come out, you know, and he relishes like telling this story. I've heard it so many times, you know, and the details shift and change a little bit, but I got kind of sick of hearing about it, you know? So I thought if I recorded it on a record and put it out publicly, then I don't have to fucking hear it again, you know?
Well, as a Swede with my foreskin intact, I can't help wonder why that ritual is still accepted. I mean,
let's look at the facts here. Let's look at the facts. There was research done in sub-Saharan Africa that demonstrate that it renders your chance of contracting HIV 50% to what it does if you're not circumcised, you know? So there's an argument that it's hygienic, you know? And also, it's completely common practice in America.
I know, but a lot of strange things are common practice in America.
I know, but that's the capital of the empire, right? That's the seat of that's Rome, you know? And if Rome says chop, then chop.
And God apparently likes it.
God is on their side, evidently, you know? I mean, it has been for some time now.
But your circumcision didn't hurt as much as your brother's.
No, I had a circumcision that, as I mentioned at the start of the track, I think, you know, I mean, we're getting away from the point here. I think it looks nicer as well, you know? I think just on a purely aesthetic level, I think a penis with a foreskin, it looks like it's wearing a kind of like baggy turtleneck, you know? It looks like, it renders a penis like kind of inconclusive looking, you know? Like it's not kind of assured of itself somehow.
I read about this guy who was not circumcised, who went out on a date with some American girl who actually thought that he had some kind of
problem.
Well, yes, that his penis was misshaped or that he was an alien or something.
When I was little, you know, before I'd really clocked what had gone on, what a circumcision is or was or whatever, you know, and I would take in a piss in primary school and I would look at the other boys, you know what I mean? I would see it and I would think, man, that just looks wrong. It looks bizarre to me, you know, because obviously I've always looked down and seen
but still, like, you know, doing things like that to your body, you should be allowed to do that when you're 18. Then you can, like, get piercings and everything.
Well, I think it's kind of like, look, you know, do I agree with what happened to my brother? I think it's not my place to agree or disagree. You know, I think it's one culture's ritual masculinization and it's another culture's child abuse, you know? And my unfortunate big brother had to ride both of those trains at once.
And you shot a video for this in Algeria, in the town where your father grew up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's basically you walking through the streets, bumping into people, a bit like the Verve's Bittersweet Symphony.
Yeah.
but there's really nothing sweet about the track. It's, and you have these strange blue contact lenses on.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of really step into the Richard Ashcroft space. You know, I wanted to occupy, I like to go method with a video, you know? So it was like...
Who goes method on a music video?
I think it's called commitment, my friend. Well. But I was wandering, and I got the fucking flu when I was out there, you know? And so I was wandering around this bad old mountain town, you know, trying to hustle together like a shitty old car that I could walk on, you know, with broken signal on my phone, showing these people, you know, these Algerians. No, I didn't speak any French, you know, like the Ashcroft video, and trying to explain... like what I'm doing, you know. But yeah, tough one.
How much time have you spent in Algeria?
I was there for a few months when I was little, a few times, and then I went back when I was like 18 for a while, and then I went there for 3 months with my first band, the Saudis, you know. We couldn't write any songs in London, so we were like, let's move to the mountains, and we lived there for 3 months, and we actually did a little touring out there, you know? And it was just like, you play these halls in these mountain towns, and it'd just be like 600 men, you know? Just like, the small towns, they were just, and we couldn't play shit, you know? Two chords, like, but they were just like, you know, aghast, you know? What the fuck is this? But in the slightly bigger towns, they went absolutely nuts, you know? This is a guy on that tour of Algeria. This guy was out there with us. He was part of that band, the Saudis, Alex Sebley. And we went our separate ways after Fat White Family started. And this is his new project, new-ish, and it's Pre-Goblin. And this is their big hit, I guess, Combustion.
Spontaneous combustion, that's an interesting way to go.
It's an interesting way to go, you know. It's an interesting one when you consider Alexander Sebley's kind of nature, you know. He's kind of sloth-like, you know. He's not really going in for the spontaneity kind of, I don't think, so much. You know, spontaneous combustion.
How did your father end up in England?
My dad ended up in England. I think he got like a scholarship or something to study engineering, you know, like all the, like the young lads in the mountain towns, you know, that's the big dream, the big ambition, you know, go and become an engineer, you know. And I think he was quite a bright lad, you know, when he was younger. So he was sent over there, I guess, like in his late teens, early 20s, and he wound up living in Huddersfield. I think he went to Huddersfield Polytechnic to get his bachelor's degree, and then he was at Manchester or whatever. And that's where he met my mom, at a place called Johnny's Nightclub, you know? Yeah, kind of coal mining town. But I think his plan was to go back to Algeria. That was always the idea. He was going to go study and go back, because he didn't really appreciate English culture, and he's never assimilated.
Why didn't he appreciate English culture, what was this?
I think it's just like sordid, I think, you know. I think if you spend enough time in Algeria in the mountains, you know, at first you're like, God, it's so boring and tedious, and, you know, you don't see women anywhere, and it's kind of like, this is just fucking backwards, man, you know. But if you spend long enough there, you start to assimilate a little bit, you know. It's like there's this absence of, like, consumer culture and sex, especially. It's just not there. You know, if you stay there long enough, you just stop masturbating. And this was like in my early 20s, you know? And I remember like getting back to Heathrow after 3 months, and there's just breasts everywhere and like temptation everywhere. And it's just like, God, this place is like, you know, it's kind of like Babylon or something. But my dad was in Huddersfield, and he got my mom knocked up, and then that's how he ended up marooned in England, you know? Classic.
But there's a Swedish singer who has Berber roots.
Yeah.
Loreen, who won the Eurovision Song Contest for the second time last year.
Right.
She's from a Berber family as well.
Okay. I didn't realize that. I didn't know. You don't get a lot of them. You don't hear a lot
about Berber people.
Mm.
So your father thought that the UK was sordid. How did he react to his son becoming the lead singer of one of the most sordid groups ever?
I think he took it kind of well. I mean, he comes to the odd show, you know. I think he's always been a little bit like, you know, when are you going to grow up? When are you going to get like a normal job? When are you going to kind of like stop disappointing me, you know?
But he still comes to the shows.
So there's this implication. I think my dad's dad was very, very harsh on him, you know. My dad's dad was, you know, he did 25 years in Cayenne in a penal colony, you know, like for murder. You know, he was shipped out from Algeria to French Guiana, you know, for a murder he didn't commit, allegedly. But he did 20 years and then he came back. He did 20 years and then he did 5 years of this thing called like chômage or whatever, where you have to work the colony. Then he came back.
Did you meet your grandfather?
I met him when I was tiny, yeah, when I was tiny. I don't remember him, you know. But that's when he came back and had a family. And I think he was an incredibly harsh disciplinarian, you know. And I think one of the things that he injected into my dad was this kind of sense that you just keep telling someone they're a failure until they try harder, you know. So I have that with my dad where it's like, you know, you're not working hard enough. You know what I mean? What have you done? It's nothing. And I think it's kind of an affectation, but at the same time, after a while, you're kind of like, you know, this is a bit fucking tiring, you know, but he comes to the shows, you know?
Maybe it was the hardest on your big brother. It's usually like that.
Yeah, the prototype sucked up the disillusionment and confusion and stuff. I think he got the worst of it. Yeah, you know? But I mean, my dad's not like, he's turned his back on Islam a long time ago, so he's not like conservative in the kind of Islamic sense, you know.
What about your mother? What was she like when you grew up?
My mother is like kind of just like wildly empathetic, like deeply maternal kind of woman, you know, like the opposite of my father, you know, just incredibly kind of loving and tender, you know. But also a joker, like also like black sense of humor, you know.
Your second album was called The Songs for Our Mothers. Did she appreciate that record?
I mean, it's kind of an unlistenable kind of record, I think, for a lot of people. You know, I think maybe it's got Whitest Boy on the Beach and Hits, Hits, Hits. But I don't know. I don't think it's like really, it's not really mom zone, you know what I mean? Like, not my kind of mom anyway.
But still that title, Songs for Our Mothers.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you got to do your little bit, you know, when you can. Make them feel appreciated, you know.
Let's go back to yesterday when a phone call cost a dime. In New Orleans, just a nickel. Turn back the hands of time. Turn back the hands of time.
I mean, this is one of my favorite endings to a song ever. You know, if we're on the subject of parents and all that, this is Randy Newman, My Country.
Sofa and some chairs. Television turned on for tonight. Picture woman, two children seated. Man lying there. Face is softly glowing in light.
It's basically a song about a family watching TV together.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. I love that when people get kind of like microscopic on a subject in a song, you know, when you don't like go for the, or when you find the macro embedded in the micro, you know, like there's something lovely and kind of paradoxical about that. You get this whole kind of like American kind of vista in just like the image of this family sat on their arse watching TV, you know. It's quite beautiful.
I'm not sure if he meant this when he wrote the song, but, you know, in hindsight, a family watching TV together has this sense of community that you don't really have anymore. Everyone has their own screens.
Yeah, so I mean, that's the thing. I think it seemed like it was kind of degenerate before. Like, oh, you know, I mean, everybody just sits around watching the box, you know. But things have gotten so much darker. People have become so much more atomized than they were before, you know. Now it is like, I mean, people can't, yeah, families can't even watch TV together anymore, right? Everybody has their own curated distraction.
We got comedy, tragedy, everything for better be watching other people. Having other people's voices fill our minds. Thank you, Jesus.
This summer, Instacart presents famous summer flavors coming to your front door. Or pool. Or hotel.
Your grocery delivery has arrived, sir.
That was faster than room service.
No violins in the lobby.
Oh, seriously? Anyway, sit back, relax, and get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Starring your favorite snacks, drinks, and more.
Download Instacart for free delivery on your first three orders. Rated H for hungry audiences. Offer valid for a limited time. Minimum $10 per order. Excludes restaurants. Additional terms and fees apply.
It can be hard balancing taking care of kids, senior loved ones, and yourself. Remember, it's okay to ask for help. There's a reason 29 million families have turned to Care.com. Find background-checked sitters, nannies, and senior caregivers who can help with everything from watching kids after school to senior meal prep. Whether you need full-time, part-time, or even occasional help, you can view rates and book highly rated caregivers that fit your budget and schedule. Get the help you need with Care.com.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Is it true that you used to live in a pub on Stockwell Road?
I did, yeah. I lived above the Queen's Head pub, which was one of the last true kind of degenerate kind of pubs in London, you know, where it was like, you know, where there were more drug dealers than drug users in there on a Friday night, you know. And I think the cops knew about it, but they were okay because it was like all in one place and there was never any violence, you know. But I was a pizza chef there. I rehearsed there. I slept there, I made love there, I attended the bar there. Sometimes weeks would go by and I wouldn't make it any further than the local corner shop to buy tobacco, you know? Like I was just Mr. fucking Queen's Head, you know?
So you were a pizza chef?
I was the pizza chef. I ran a kitchen above the pub. It was called Grande Finocchio's Pizzeria, you know? And I gave the pizzas all these kind of political names. Like I had like a middle class guilt calzone and
a middle class guilt calzone.
Yeah, I think it had like artichokes and goat cheese, you know. And then I had like a hang Cameron, as in like David Cameron, you know, which was like Parma ham and olives, and you know what I mean. It was like a naked picture of me on the menu, you know, like with a big bit of salami, that kind of thing. Erotic pizzeria.
Interesting how you made something artistic from a job like that.
I think you got to keep yourself amused, whatever you're doing, right?
What other jobs did you have before you could live off your music?
I think live is a strong word, but anyway.
Survive.
Survive, yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's more appropriate. I've done all kinds of jobs, you know. I guess the most notable one that has cropped up again recently when I've been going through the kind of tundra of promo and interview season is... The worst was I worked as an invigilator at the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich. So it's just a museum dedicated to the history of ships, right? Which is, you know, the most boring fucking museum imaginable, you know? And the only article they had there of any interest to the general public was Nelson's jacket that he'd been shot in at Trafalgar, right? So you were there all day with a clip-on tie. You weren't allowed to sit down or read a book in these rooms full of, like, paintings of seascapes and whatever. And people all day would just say, you know, where's Nelson's jacket, you know? But there was one room there that was dedicated to the history of timepieces, you know? So you were just in this grand big room and there were 1,000 clocks, you know. There were digital clocks, atomic clocks, you know, like the whole room was just like clicking your life away, you know. So you'd be in there on a fucking like MDMA come down on a Tuesday, you know, dying. And all day you'd have nothing to do except, you know, where's Nelson's jacket, you know?
Wow.
that was one of them, you know. But I did a lot of shitty jobs. I had a job at a meat packing plant, you know, in Northern Ireland.
That sounds harsh.
It was harsh, but it had a kind of like, again, to bring it back to the boss, it had a kind of Springsteen-esque romanticism about it, you know. You were in there with the working man, you know, in a giant freezer just sifting through flesh, you know, like from like 5 a.m. until whenever. You didn't have a finishing time. It depended on the size of the order from the supermarkets, you know. So you might be there for 4 hours, you might be there for 9 hours, you know. And the place just had this really distinctive, fleshy kind of like, I mean, it were pretty brutal, you know. Lots of blood. Yeah, but I'd choose that over the Timepiece Museum. Marlene Dietrich, Falling in Love Again. I mean, it doesn't get any more romantic than that.
Love's always been my game. Play it how I may. I was made that way. I can't help it. Men cluster to me like moths around the flame. And if their wings burn, I know I'm not.
This, of course, is from the movie that made her famous, The Blue Angel.
Yeah. It's just that conjures up so many different kind of, like, I don't know, images. You know, I think it was Francis Bacon's favorite song. Somebody told me that. That might not, you'd have to fact check that.
I just read the book that Dietrich's daughter wrote about her mother, where she doesn't really come across as a great mom.
No,
because she her daughter, she writes that she realized at the age of 3 that she didn't have a mom, but she was like, she had a queen that she was supposed to help. So yeah, they worked together for decades to uphold the myth of
Marlene
Dietrich, the star.
Yeah.
And she couldn't play with other kids when she was young, and one of the few girls that she was allowed to play with was Judy Garland.
Right.
Who, like Maria Riva, the daughter of Dietrich, was a bit chubby.
Right, okay.
So they would hang out, and Maria, the daughter of Dietrich, gave a hot dog to Judy Garland that she wasn't allowed to eat because she was on this like diet of oranges and amphetamines, or grapefruit and amphetamines.
The classic
Hollywood diet.
That's
diet.
I'll be doing that until tour, you know what I mean? It's nothing, you know what I mean? It's the least you can do for your audience.
You mentioned somewhere that you mostly release records to be able to play something new when you go on tour and hopefully make enough money to pay for the therapy that you need. How much therapy have you had?
You know what? I've actually just started therapy for the first time in my life. I went to therapy I've tried it like 3 or 4 times in the past, and I went and I sat and I chatted for an hour, felt really awkward and uncomfortable and didn't see the point because I was kind of like, well, in order for me to give you like the background, you know, I'm going to have to give you like £5,000, you know, we're going to have to be here for hours, you know, talking about my fucking dad and all the rest of it. But I think that was the wrong kind of like, I think I was misunderstanding the premise of the whole kind of thing, you know. But I've started recently because the stuff around the album got a bit hectic for me, you know, but I've been combining it with boxing, like boxing and therapy, I think at the same time. Is a good combo, you know. I found like you can go and just unload all your shit, you know, and then like what's left, the residue, you can just pound it out of a stranger or a bag, you know.
You don't really come across as the boxing type of person. You have a very slim body.
I'm not the kind of boxing type. I didn't think, and it was a friend of mine, my friend Kate, and she said a few months ago, I was saying like I can't fucking deal with this band and all this stuff. It's driving me fucking nuts. And she's like, you know, she had all kinds of problems with her family or whatever. And she's like, therapy and boxing, the double-pronged attack, you know?
I get this image of you pounding away on the meats in that meat packing.
The meat pack, yeah, yeah, back to basics, yeah. You know? But it's something about being in like a sweat-drenched railway arch in South London with like a really large Eastern European man like pounding on you on a Friday evening. And you're there and it's like, it's just not that bad, you know? It's like, it's not that bad. And I don't know, it changes you in some way, you know? Like it's, I find it really cleanses you psychologically, you know?
You tried microdosing acid on your third album and combining that with doing ketamine in the evenings, which is an anesthetic used by veterinarians.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically, does that like open up the gates to creativity or does it make you less inhibited?
Yeah, I think what happens with ketamine more than any other kind of hallucinogenic is that like your brain, I think, compartmentalizes everything, obviously, for your own kind of, for your own good, right? In order for you to kind of function within like consensus reality, okay? So everything has to be divided into its specific ontological kind of box, right? Otherwise, everything's just a kind of mush. But I think when you ingest a specific amount of ketamine, everything starts to flow into everything else in a way that's completely different to acid or mushrooms or anything like that. Time especially and time and place are just like molten. You know, if you take enough of the stuff, if you're in the K-hole, you can be in a kind of like Byzantine, you know, dreamscape, you know.
But I thought that being in the K-hole was like being completely isolated, not being able to move or do anything.
Yeah, in your physical, in the corpus, but like in your mind, you're on a kind of celestial voyage of indescribable kind of like wonder. It's like a complete out-of-body kind of experience. But yeah, you want to be somewhere safe and, you know what I mean? You don't K-hole on stage. That would be a non-gig. I mean, I wouldn't recommend taking ketamine on stage unless you really know your limits, you know?
I remember that the Chemical Brothers wrote this song called Lost in the K-Hole.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was about that kind of experience.
I've been there many, many times, but I would recommend it to anybody. I'd say it's a kind of spiritual kind of voyage that you can go on.
You almost mention it on the track John Lennon on your new album.
Yeah.
Where you mentioned something about a horse tranquil.
Or, yeah, my horse.
I'm not sure if I got that right.
Yeah, yeah, because I was, you know, I was on a like a head full of K to boot, you know, and you know, she these words she spoke into my horse tranquil glare. It's just when I met Yoko Ono, I was on a lot of ketamine, and she told me I reminded her of her husband.
How did you meet her?
I was up at Sean's place, Sean and Yoko's place, and
Sean Lennon, of course.
Sean Lennon, yeah, yeah. In upstate New York, I was there to write lyrics for Insecure Men, and they hadn't arrived yet. So me and Sean were hanging out, having a bottle of wine or whatever. Yoko comes into the room. I didn't realize I was going to meet Yoko. She's got a bad back or whatever. So Sean starts giving her a massage. That's how the song starts, you know? And I'm just thinking, wow, this is the fucking weirdest thing I've ever seen, you know? Like, if it gets any weirder than this, you know, if it gets any weirder than this, it just becomes unweird. You know, you start coming back, you know, it's like the curvature of the weird sphere. But afterwards she was like, yeah, you know, you remind me of my husband, you know, he was a singer too, you know. So, oh, interesting, you know, like what band's he in, you know? Like, you know what I mean? Like, and then I was thinking like, you know, like I was possessed by the spirit of John, but it was the bastard John, not the peace and love John, you know? And he'd been in the afterlife for like 40 years on his own, and he was fucking sick of it. So he was kind of hectoring Yoko through the conduit of me, you know, like I was a kind of ketamine conduit.
On that song, John Lennon.
On that song, yeah.
Have Sean or Yoko heard the track yet?
I don't think so.
No.
I mean, we just have to wait and see with that one, you know? I mean, I hope it's not like an issue. I thought of it as a kind of Fluxus-style kind of almost prankish kind of thing, but it's not like a diss or anything. It's just like a really fucking, you know, to me, that was one of the strangest things that had ever happened, you know, like it was just really, really odd. It's odd meeting Yoko on anyway, but if you're spangled on K at the time, then it's really weird, you know.
Together with the author Adele Stripe, you wrote a book about Fat White Family called A Thousand Apologies.
10,000 apologies.
Oh, sorry, 10,000 apologies.
We've got to add to that now as well. I've got to update it.
You've
sinned each edition.
Even more. Anyway, she famously described you as a drug band with a rock problem.
Mm. I don't know where that catchphrase comes from. I think that's appropriated from somewhere else. You know, I think that's reductive, but it makes a good punchline.
So someone must have said that about some other group previously, right?
Yeah, it's one of those things that gets attributed to this. God knows where that originally came from.
But one part of the book, which definitely has not happened to any other group, is where you write about how you played La Cigale, the nightclub in Paris, on Friday the 13th of November in 2015. The night that terrorists attacked the Eagles of Death Metal concert at Le Bataclan.
Yeah.
And your show was cut short.
It was. We were playing Bomb Disneyland at that point in time, the intro to Bomb Disneyland. I think we were right at the end or near the end of our set. And, you know, you at that stage of our trajectory, you know, it still looked like we had it all to play for. You know, we hadn't fucked our lives up so grotesquely by that point. We were still fucking our lives, you know. But you're on stage in Paris at the Cigale, you're headlining. It's like a dream, you know. And the last thing you want to do is come off stage, you know. And this guy's coming over, like, you need to get off stage, you need to get off stage. I'm fuck you, like, I'm not getting off stage, you know. Like, this is my moment, man. This is my special moment. And he kept coming over, and he was like, you have to get off stage. There's been, like, an attack. There's been an attack. And, fucking attack, you know. But then it was, like, really insistent. And then everything got shut down. And I had no idea, you know, because I'm just in that kind of, like, ego gig kind of whirlwind, you know. My dad's in the audience and my stepmom happens to be there, you know. And then we're in a backstage room and they're like, you can't come out, like, don't leave, you just stay here, stay hidden here, you know. And it still didn't register. I just wanted to get high on coke and go and find somebody to, like, you know, have sex with, you know what I mean? It wasn't until, like, the next day when it was like, what, you know, like, what the fuck had happened, you know? It was extreme, but it proper ruined the rest of the tour.
And then your guitar player went off to score drugs.
And didn't come back. Yeah, he didn't get in the van the next day. That was what Saul, that was one of the first departures of Saul, you know, where it was just like, he just didn't show up to get in the van, you know? So we were kind of like a man down, you know? We lost a man.
But you weren't worried that he might have been killed?
No. We weren't worried about that. No, he's like a bad penny. He always turns up, that guy.
But it kind of makes you wonder if the terrorists picked the Eagles of Death Metal because they knew that there were Muslims in the Fat White Family.
I think if you're gonna gone down a concert, right? If you're gonna machine gun a concert, and you know you're gonna die doing this, so this is the last thing you're ever gonna do. You probably Google the concert, right? You'd probably Google the concert. You wouldn't just Google the venue. You'd probably Google, right, what's going on that night, you know? So maybe, just maybe, the fact that. Because it's almost exactly the same size venue, you know? But there must have been something like that going on. I mean, I guess they're Americans. Maybe that was a big difference, you know? Like, it's an American band, you know? Possibly. Who knows? We'll never know.
I wondered, though, if they checked out your lyrics to see if... So, these guys are Muslims. They don't seem like very good Muslims.
That's true. In fact, they probably didn't research it because it would have been even more of an insult to Islam. It would like these guys are completely haram. Like, these need to be the first, you know, take the fucking band out first, then deal with the crowd, you know, fuck these guys, you know, like.
But do you believe in God?
Do I believe in God? I mean, we've taken a pivot into the deep end there, right? I think there's something, there's an otherness, isn't there, about everything. There's a very much, there's a strangeness, there's a kind of unquantifiable aspect to existence, which suggests that there's something just beyond our common kind of perception. I think there's something going on. I don't know if you call that God or whatever. I think there's something kind of beyond, I guess, you know. I mean, I'm 38, so I've not quite hit my kind of like Eastern phase yet, but it's coming. It's in the post. Do you believe in God?
I'm not sure. I had this artist called Father John Misty on the podcast.
Yeah.
And he only played religious songs, mostly like Christian music, like music from Bob Dylan's Christian Face and stuff like that. And he said that he only believed that we could meet God through other people, that there's no point in isolating yourself trying to find God. But, you know, when we hang out with other people, we can actually experience something spiritual just by that sense of community. That's where God is. That was his idea.
I think it depends on the community, really, you know? I don't think you'd find a lot of God at a Father John Misty concert, you know?
But you have a track called Religion for One, though, on the record.
We do have Religion for One. That's like a kind of... I was reading a lot of E.M. Suran during the pandemic, you know, kind of like the blackest laughter you've ever heard.
Oh.
You know? I love that guy. I don't know if you've read him.
I haven't, no.
Romanian pessimist. It's kind of Nietzschean, but... It's kind of more comical than Nietzsche, I think, you know. But I don't know. I guess that's that thing where everybody lives in their own kind of hermetically sealed, you know, digitally kind of curated selfscape, you know. Everybody is their own kingdom now. And I guess that's kind of what I'm alluding to a little bit. With a tongue in the cheek, you know.
The tongue is always in the cheek.
I can't get the tongue out of the cheek, you know what I mean? I just can't take myself completely seriously at any given moment. In a desert where we'll be here, sick laughing in that it ain't prayer. I'll help to kill you. Meanwhile, I'll tear. Okay, this is one of my favorite Fall tracks. I think it's got the... I think it contains the immortal line, 50%... No. I think it's, 99% of all non-smokers die, which is one of my favorite Fall lyrics. But this is 50-Year-Old Man by The Fall.
I'm a 50-year-old male. I'm a 50-year-old male.
Did you get to see The Fall live?
I did, yeah. I played with them at Glastonbury. They were on right after us. Yeah. That was when we had a bit of a run-in with The Fall, actually.
In what way?
Well, we were sharing a backstage area at Glastonbury, you know, like back at the park stage. And Marky Smith was sat there with a bottle of champagne. This is the middle of the afternoon. The sun's beating down, 3 o'clock or whatever, you know. And I'm there and I'm like, you know, Marky Smith's one of my idols. He's up there with Leonard Cohen, you know what I mean? And I'm like, you know, I'm not speaking to the guy because I'm too shy, you know. But my little brother's a bit of a cheeky little knacker, you know. So he goes up and he's like, you know, can I have a bit of your champagne, Mark, you know? And Mark's like, yeah, sit down, kid, you know. And Nathan sits there. Mark pours him out a measure of champagne and then just tosses it in his face. You know, and my mum's there at the time as well, you know, like, because it's Glastonbury, your mum's come down, you know. She said, what do you do that for, you bastard, you know? And Nathan's walking around trying to get the champagne out of his eyes, and he's like, really? And I'm stood there watching this, and I'm like, I should stand up for my brother, you know? This guy just hurled, you know, it's just fucking abuse, you know? But I'm just frozen because it's Marky Smith, you know? You can't, what are you going to do? He's like a god, you know? And he kind of like, look, I'm only joking with the kid, he says to my brother, you know. And then he's like, you know, I'll pour you some cider. We got some cider. Nathan's like, my brother's like, you're not going to throw that in my face again, are you, you know? You're not going to throw it in my face, Mark, because there'll be trouble, you know. He's like, no, I promise. I'm sorry, kid. So he pours my little brother a glass of cider. My brother just fucking tosses it in Marky Smith's face straight away, you know. And he's there with The Fall. And they're all these, like, bards from Manchester with black leather jackets. And they all get up and they're all, like, fucking screaming abuse, you know. And Mark's like, argh! He's got all this beer in his face and his eyes. He's sitting there all shriveled, you know. He's nearly dead at this point, you know. And there's The Fall, and then there's the gang from South London and my mum in the middle of it, and everybody's just fucking screaming at each other backstage.
I love that your mum was part of this.
Yeah,
you know, that's really like great parenting, when you stand up for your kids
even in
the backstage area.
Even in that moment, you know? But it was like my stepdad was there as well, who's like an accountant, you know? And we were all screaming at each other, and then it kind of calmed down, and suddenly everybody was friends with each other, you know? And my stepdad was there like inquiring about doing his accounts or whatever. But Mark disappeared into his wigwam before going on stage, and we could hear him screaming at his missus or whatever, like, because he didn't have any spare trousers. So he had this big streak of beer down here, you know? And then he went on stage, and the BBC reported that he'd gone on stage after having pissed himself. Yeah. And there's a photo of him there with just this big streak down his leg, you know? And the band, the fat whites, you can see them watching from the corner of the stage, you know? I guess it's kind of, that was the high point of our existence.
Another interesting star that you've hung out with is Lady Gaga.
Yeah.
You put her on the guest list for one of your shows in New York.
Le Poisson Rouge. She came down to that, yeah.
And then you had some kind of late night jam session where you wrote songs about sex trafficking.
I had a lyric about, we were all there. I mean, it was kind of like tragic kind of jam zone, you know what I mean? Too late in the day or whatever, you know. But Sean's got this kind of studio in New York, you know. And we're all there until 4 a.m. or whatever. But I had this song, Come to Me Villa, that I was trying to kind of find a home for, you know, which has ended up a Odysseus track, actually, Come to Me Villa. Check it out. But yeah, it's all about when I visited Pattaya when I was like in my early 20s with my degenerate big brother, you know, and we were like picking prostitutes up in a pickup truck, you know. I was like riding around Pattaya with like 7 prostitutes in a pickup truck. But anyway, I was trying to get that down, and Gaga was there like singing this thing, and it was kind of like, yeah, it was another one of those cherished occasions. This is my main man, you know? I mean, it's between Leonard and Bob, but today it's Bob, you know, and this is Key West.
McKinley Holler, McKinley Small, Dr. Sue McKinley, her death is on the wall. Say it to me, have you got something to confess? I heard all about it. He was going down slow. I heard it all. The wireless radio from down in the boondocks, way down in Key West. I'm searching for love, but it's.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
It can be hard balancing taking care of kids, senior loved ones, and yourself. Remember, it's okay to ask for help. There's a reason 29 million families have turned to Care.com. Find background-checked sitters, nannies, and senior caregivers who can help with everything from watching kids after school to senior meal prep. Whether you need full-time, part-time, or even occasional help, you can view rates and book highly rated caregivers that fit your budget and schedule. Get the help you need with Care.com.
Wayfair's Labor Day clearance is back, and we're bringing end of summer deals right to your doorstep. Now through September 3rd, score up to 70% off all things home. Get in on low prices while temperatures are still high, like up to 70% off rugs, up to 50% off bedroom furniture, up to 50% off dining furniture, and up to 60% off living room seating. And the savings don't stop there. End summer with can't-miss surprise flash deals, all with fast shipping right to your doorstep. Save big on everything you need, with every style, for every home, for every budget. Modern? Check. Classic? Check. Coastal grandma with a hint of boho glam? Check and check. Wayfair's got everything you need to make your home way more you. Shop Wayfair's Labor Day clearance now through September 3rd for up to 70% off. Because at Wayfair, new season means new savings.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is a song from the album that he put out during the pandemic.
Yeah, you see.
Which I don't listen to a lot of Bob Dylan, but I really like that song, I Contain Multitudes.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah. I think it's kind of like, I think it's kind of maybe my favorite Bob Dylan album, you know? Like every kind of Bob album is just like a kind of one remove from actual Bob. And I feel like it's taken him his whole life to arrive at pure Bob, you know? Like that album, there's nothing between you and Bob anymore. There's an intimacy to it.
And this was during the pandemic. During the pandemic, you attempted to shoot a remake of The Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, a shot-by-shot remake of The Shawshank Redemption with Alex Sebley from Pre-Goblin, who we started the podcast with.
How do you come up with an idea like that?
Well, I was marooned in Algeria, you know, as the pandemic was coming down. I was in Algeria and we were going to go out there, the band, and make an album out there because there were no heroin or drugs out there, you know, kind of like jihadi Graceland, you know.
Jihadi Graceland.
But all the airports were closing down one by one. I was there with my little brother.
It sounds like an amusement park, the jihadi Graceland.
Jihadi Graceland, yeah. It, you know, that's when I die, that's my flat in West Norwood. That's what I want it to be. We came back from Algeria with our tail between our legs, me and my brother. We were at our dad's house. I was at my dad's house, started the pandemic, lasted about 8 days before we had a terrible, terrible row. And then I moved back to London to live in the spare room with Alex Sebley from Pre-Goblin. And we just thought, well, this is it now. You know, we're all in prison. So why don't we, you know, we've got so much time on our hands. Why don't we remake the whole of The Shawshank Redemption on our phones? It just seemed like the natural way to pass the time, you know. We had a kind of like one shot rule though to begin with, you know, no second takes, you know, everything was just one shot. But then, like, as it picked up a bit of traction online, as the numbers started to go up on Instagram, you know, eventually we had like 12,000 people watching every night.
Can you still watch that?
I think it exists on YouTube or something, you know. You'd have to inquire with Pre-Goblin, they'll be able to point you in the right direction. But Alex Sebley is a perfectionist, you know, and he got kind of auteur about everything. You know, he wanted the right angle and he wanted to. And then I was like, I can't do this. I can't spend the pandemic. And I really regret that, like, now, you know. I wish I'd finished it because it would have been like a real monument, I think, you know. But I didn't have the fluids, you know.
But that's one of your favorite movies, I guess.
I mean, it's isn't that just like everyone's favorite movies? I mean, it's irresistible, right?
Yeah, I quite like it.
It's great. I think it's like it's schlocky, you know. It's great schlock, you know.
What does schlock mean?
Schlock is kind of like you know, it's not like high art. It's not like serious. You know what I mean? It's kind of like. Like Spielberg, a lot of the time is kind of schlock, you know. Oh. It's kind of warm and fuzzy. It's like comfort food or something, but like cultural comfort food, schlock. I don't know if maybe I've just made that word up, schlock. I don't know. I hope not, because that's embarrassing if I have, you know. But there we go.
You are what you sacrifice, amalgam of pain. Should your misplaced foresight leads you to my door again.
Okay, well, look, Frederick, it's been an absolute pleasure. It's been an honor. But I do have to get going now, you know.
I'm so happy to have had you here, Elias. Oh, thank you very much.
No, thank you. The pleasure is all mine.
Den här podcasten producerades av Daniel Bäckström för Leon Media. Lia Saudi från Fat White Family var hemma hos Dragan.